This is Bill Nelson here, the director of the Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center at Johns Hopkins, and here today with a very special guest, Annie Applegarth. Now, Annie is a cancer survivor, and she's been a real force behind Swim Across America. So we're going to talk about both of these things. Annie, how did you learn about cancer, and tell us your story?
It was sort of an odd set of circumstances. I had gone in to have a lump in my breast checked, thinking I may have found something. That turned out to be nothing, but during the course of the test, I reached back and felt something sort of between my shoulder blades, connective tissue. And my theory was, let me check the other side. If it's on the other side, it's supposed to be there. If it's not, then let's get it looked at. I pointed it out to my doctor at the time, and very quickly everybody stood up and said, oh, it's nothing, let's go get it biopsied. We went around the corner and down the elevator, and the doctor biopsied it. I went home, it was a Friday night, thinking, oh, it's nothing. And by Wednesday of the next week, they had indicated that, in fact, it was something. And that I needed to have it removed surgically, and that there was a potential, depending on the grade of the tumor and the type of tumor, that I may have to have radiation and chemotherapy as a result of it. Turned out it was a low grade, which means it hadn't gone to my lymph nodes or my lungs or anything, but they still felt that it was large enough that I should continue with a short course of radiation and a short course of chemotherapy, very coarse. Of course, it was the hottest summer on God's earth, and so I felt like I was dying every day. My brother, who was my primary caretaker during the time, had sort of set up a lair in the bathroom because the tile was cold, and that I just wanted to be against things that were cold and smooth and soft. But, you know, the summer seemed much longer because it was hot, but it was really a very short course of treatment because soft tissue sarcomas really have no predisposition. Nobody really has a clear idea, or at the time, you may correct me, had a clear idea of how you get them or where you get them. You get tested much more frequently than the average bear to make sure. So, so far, knock on wood, but I'm, you know, dunk. There's been no reoccurrence.
So I have a question for you. Getting through treatment, you know, through the heat of the summer and the like, is that at some point between undergoing a biopsy and having surgical removal and having them say, this is a sarcoma, kind of a cancer, and you're going to need to look at most of the major treatments we use, surgery, radiation therapy, chemotherapy, and the like, at some moment the cancer problem became very personally real.
Yes, absolutely.
And then what I find is so remarkable about people who are treated for cancer and get through these kinds of treatment courses is just as that realization occurs, we're off and running and starting treatment. How did you cope with that sort of jump into the deep end of the pool? We'll get to that later,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, actually, you know, it's interesting because, you know, the doctor that originally I had gone to was a doctor I'd been going to since childhood. And all the doctors that initially found it were people that I knew growing up. And everyone kept saying, it's going to be fine. And so I thought, it's going to be fine. I'm sort of more of a glass half full kind of person. But then you're there. Then when you do the surgery, you're thinking, oh, I've had my tonsils out. It didn't quite connect at the surgery. When they put the port in, and you're going to have this port for a while.
This was a port to allow ready access to your venous blood, so they could inject things through it and withdraw blood from it, so they didn't turn you into a pincushion.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Then suddenly it's thank you, thank you, Dr. Nelson. It's suddenly more real because you have this thing that's just there all the time, and it's tender and it's icky, and I'm like, if there's a something in my mouth that I can rub my tongue against 400 times, I'm that girl. So of course, you know, I had to touch it 400 times, but and I didn't really want to tell anybody because suddenly, you know, you're like a, excuse this, probably a bad expression, but like a rabbit in a mascara lab. Suddenly everybody's looking at you a little bit differently. And so I sort of just told my brother and my immediate family because I didn't think anybody would notice. That wasn't the whole truth. But so the first thing that really happened for me was a level of anxiety that I had never experienced in my life. I was never an anxious person, never somebody who worried. But then suddenly the level of anxiety contributed to, I have cancer. They're not kidding around. I'm not kidding around. My brother moved in with me at the time because I was, you know, all the worst possible health situations. I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't, you know, eating. I wasn't taking care of myself. I just was sort of in a constant anxious state. At my doctor's recommendation, started an anti-anxiety medicine. So, you know, all things that in my happy-go-lucky world started to compile into my life is going to be much different even when I survived this. And how I look at the world is going to be very different when I survived this.
Well, there's a question for you that I don't know anyone who's had this kind of experience with cancer and its treatment that ever looks at the world in the same way. And in fact, many people really contemplate things like, you know, could this be a lethal threat to me? What would that mean? And you start making judgments on what kinds of experiences do I want to have? How do I want to live my life? And when that threat, thank God for many people these days, subsides greatly, then these changes that people have made in their life, they very often keep, I find. So has that been your...
No, I think that's absolutely been true for me. I think more in a gratitude sense. I write a gratitude blog every day, a photograph of something that has happened to me or that I've done or that I've seen that I'm grateful for. I find my need to help people or be of assistance or walk the walk, so to speak, is much greater than it ever was before. I mean, I was never an unkind person. I never, you know, forget it. I'm not giving a quarter to the guy on the corner. But I find myself being more generous and more grateful and more appreciative of days and times in my life of seeing things that or doing things that are much more important now. Or the other thing is recognizing people in my life from before I had cancer who mean so much to me now and making the conscious effort to stay in touch with them because they had such an impact and how important that is to have someone who have been an impact, but to be someone who can make an impact.
So here's another question for you. There are so many cancer survivors these days. Thankfully, the number of cancer survivors across the country are increasing. I would almost argue perhaps even exponentially. The guess is there's at least 14.5-15 million of them or the like. One of the kinds of things you describe is this feeling that almost everyone has to some degree during treatment. It's probably the root of some of the anxiety, but it's a feeling of, people describe it as a little bit of fatigue. It often, I think, is an old quaint term called malaise, where you're pretty sure you could get up and walk across the room, but you'd rather not, whatever that feeling is, that's mm-hmm, sort of tired. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't subside for a while after treatment. How long for you after your treatment was completed did you feel back physically to where you were before?
Oh, my gosh. 4 or 5 years.
4 or 5 years. No, that's very interesting. I can remember when I was younger helping take care of someone who had Hodgkin's disease and finished treatment. This person was an avid and very competitive cyclist and so was using his cycling times to gauge his physical, you know, abilities. And when he would come back at 3 months, so I feel much better than when my treatment was over. Then at 6, I feel much better mm-hmm. than the last time. And we got out to about at least a year before he said, I've finally been able to do this at this time. I said, well, is that continuing to be better? He goes, no, I've never done it that well. So he was back. It took at least a year for someone who spent his life on physical fitness. So I actually hear this kind of tale that you're not back physically for at least a year, mm-hmm. perhaps longer. Is that, and that's been your experience,
John? Well, when I was diagnosed with cancer, I had a career that was hugely physically demanding. I was on tour with musical artists. I worked as a location manager in the film industry. In both cases, my job was first one in, last one out, and on my feet most of the time.
Oh, and these are, I know you are working that area a little bit. For our listeners, these are these things that are 15 and 18 hour days. It's really crazy when you're working, right?
Right, yeah. Exactly. So, for example, one that most listeners locally might remember is the HFS Festival that used to be at RFK Stadium. So we would go in 5 days ahead, build a stage, get artists, set up dressing rooms, order catering, blah, 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 until the artists arrive. And so you would be working 14 to 18 hour days. And I was that gal. I loved it. Loved it. Never got tired. Never was the one to poop out. That's what took a long time to return. And working in a stadium event, whether it was a soccer game or any number of things, having that come back, it took probably 4 years before I felt completely comfortable to do a week-long event of 14 to 15 hour days. That was my primary exercise. I was not the gal who then went to the gym or, rode my bike or swam in this case. So that was my level of physical endurance. And I didn't get back to that until about four years.
So another thing that I think people can be curious about is when people go through cancer treatments, many times they'll change their physical appearance. They'll lose hair, they'll do whatnot. Mm-hmm. And even as they get back to sort of more full speed physically, as they try and re-engage in the workplace, some people will describe feeling a little awkwardness in interpersonal interactions. And you're someone who isn't very awkward generally, and you quite willing to share your experiences. How were you accepted, if you will, as you returned to that kind of high-paced workplace?
Differently in different situations. So in the music industry, of which I had the longest history, not only was I welcomed back, but they made every possible accommodation to have me back. And that was a huge part, not only in my post-cancer recovery, but during my cancer recovery. That group of people was and were and are tremendously supportive.
Well, we found here at the Kimmel Cancer Center, as you know, in our one night, one show, one cause mm-hmm. kind of concerts that we have, that many of the artists in the musical business and the people who work with them have significant experiences with cancer,
right,
and are very understanding of the people that do. So.
Right. Well, and one of the managers of one of the groups I worked with ended up also having a soft tissue sarcoma like 8 years later. Several members of bands I've worked with have passed away from cancer. So it's really, and musicians support
very
many
much
of
so.
The causes. Yeah. In the film industry, it was different. But the two industries really are much different in a variety of ways. In the film industry, it did prevent me from getting some work. There are always going to be people who are younger and faster and cheaper. And so younger, faster, cheaper, and cancer-free did. But I did not have the longevity with some of those film crews, other than the local crews, that I have in the music industry. So there was a little bit of a different vibe with how I was accepted back in. But there's still, even if it's not there, it's perceived. I perceived an awkwardness. Oh, I have to ask for help in something that I didn't have to before, or I have to, you know, I'm not as good as I was before, which, you know, that's a self anxiety issue. But I've worked around it with, you know, I'm still happily welcomed back into many of the musical organization groups that I've worked with before.
So then, as you mentioned, because of this background, and of course your long history as an Olympic swimmer, just kidding, you got involved with Swim Across America, and I'm obviously joking about Olympic swimming. I gather you hadn't swum a stroke until you met some people from Swim Across America. How did that happen?
Oh, well, this is actually, and I never mind revealing my age, so I will reveal my age. But before I even knew anything about the swim, I had my 50th birthday party, and I had invited 50 people, but my 50th birthday was also the fifth year, which is a big marker in sarcomas when you pass the fifth year, of being no evidence of disease. So when you're 50 and you're single, your family, you know, everybody has a different idea about what's fun. So so I decided to throw my own birthday party and not tell anybody what I was doing. But they pulled up to my place of employee where I was having the event, and I told them to dress comfortably, and the theme of the party was teaching an old dog new tricks. And a Labrador named Millie was there with us, and when everybody drove up to the driveway, there were stilt walkers, hula hoopers, jugglers, and you had to learn one before I'd let you eat. So people of all ages and ranges came to the party, but I had invited some new friends, Betsy and Drew Jeronic, who I had met recently and who did not know I was a cancer survivor, but was part of the 50 people that were invited. And throughout the course of the party, we talked about being cancer-free and no evidence of disease and life before and life after. And at the end of the party, Betsy Jeronic said, "We're bringing this cancer event to Maryland. Would you help?" And I thought, oh, sure. You know, they want to have a little party, and I'm good at fundraising
You're
parties.
You're thinking logistics and fundraising. Yeah.
So a couple weeks later, they invite me to this planning meeting, and it's Swim Across America, Baltimore. All right. Okay. But because of my event experience, they really wanted me to organize the breakfast and tables and chairs, and so organized that, started organizing that, and then realizing that we're serving breakfast for 1,200 in a field that has no electricity, no lights, no nothing. So, okay, you know, every army travels on its belly. I'll make sure they're fed well. And about a month or two later, it was suggested that I swim. Oh, yeah, that's just great. I can do like a one-arm, goofy-legged frog crawl, but I'm not afraid of the water, but I never took swim lessons. I never swam on a swim team, never did any of that. So I said, no, I don't think that's for me. I'll happily just make sure everybody has a pancake. And they came back to me and said, there's a coach at Meadowbrook who is undergoing breast cancer treatment, and she has offered to teach you how to swim. Like, you can't say no to that, right? Oh, you'd be a real lughead if you said, you know, oh, no, thank you. I'm going to help with a cancer research project, fundraising project. I'm a cancer survivor, and somebody's offered to teach me. Okay, so we collected a team, and mostly people who were artists, people who were in the film industry or the music industry or the local arts community. There were 8 of us. And our team was happily named after the Labrador Retriever, Millie's Mermaids, which is how the name came about from the 50th birthday party. And we went faithfully twice a week to go visit Annie Lawler, who has survived breast cancer and still swims with us. One of the swimmers was terrified of putting her face in the water. And we were practicing one day, and suddenly she put her face in the water. And we were all excited. Oh, my gosh, Trish put her face in the water. And we're like, Trish, Trish. And she said, oh, no, Michael Phelps is in the next lane. So we figured all we need to do is get Michael Phelps to swim next to her, and she'll put her face in the water.
He did come to the first
one. He did come to the first one. And yeah. She swam the first one on her back. She did the whole mile backstroke, one of the mermaids. So, but all eight of us swam the open water mile. Our little team, probably that first year, raised about $18,000, and it was an amazing, amazing experience. And if I can share this part, so I'm, you know, you're out there and you're thinking, oh my God, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, I'm swimming. I wanted to go in last because I thought, you know, I can't be in this blender of people. I'll lose my mind. I'll get hit in the head and I'll cry and I'll go home. But so I'm going in last, and this guy comes in next to me. I said, no, I really want to go in last. And he says, no, they've asked me to swim with you. I'm your swim angel. And I thought, oh, how nice. And he introduces himself, and it's Craig Beardsley, one of the Olympians. And I'm thinking, well, this is, okay, they must think I really stink at swimming that they're sending an Olympian. But he laughed me, saying, oh, there are other people who need more help. You don't need my help. But as I was coming around the last buoy, my brother, who was instrumental in being my sole, my support system during cancer treatment, is not the biggest talker in the world. And I could hear him at the end of the dock, like, really yelling and screaming and cheering me on. And I thought, I'm going to cry. I'm just going to cry. Here is the one person that really has been by my side through this entire thing, who hardly speaks at all, who's screaming in front of a crowd of people, his worst anxiety, and he's doing this for me. So I just thought, okay, I now am thriving. I haven't just survived cancer because of the swim and its impact on not just me, but my whole family. I'm now 5 years thriving through this. And I literally swam until I could, my knees were banging on the bottom of the ground because I thought if I stand. So I just stood up and everybody ran out. My brother ran out. My family ran out. Annie, the coach, ran out and gave me a hug. I never went over the timing mat because I just sat there and cried because it was so, just such an amazing release. And that was the moment when I thought, throw it at me. You know, I'm going to live with some portion of the results of cancer for the rest of my life. I'm always going to think a headache is a tumor. I'm always going to think a toothache needs a bone graft. But I can thrive through this now. And that was the moment that I was really sold.
So since that time you've been really sold, we've done swim after swim. The momentum is still increasing. The number of people who swim and the amount of funds that they raise is going up. It's still a wonderful event. I say it's growing and growing, but it hasn't outgrown its charm, I would argue. It's a wonderful place to swim. Mm-hmm. The Olympians that come, Craig Beardsley is a good example. He's one of the sweetest people you'll ever meet. And when is it on for? I guess September 16th this year. You can go to the website.
Yes, September 16th is the open water swim at High Tide Farm, which Madeline Shedlick rents out to us, which is a beautiful, amazing site on the Magathy River down in Pasadena. It's the 16th at the crack of ugly in the morning, but nobody's looking because it's dark and you're in your bathing suit. And also we have a pool swim at Meadowbrook on Saturday the 15th.
Usually,
yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, all kinds of, it's not a race. All kinds of people come, children, adults, African-Americans, Asian-Americans. I mean, it's just an amazing place to be.
Well, I have to say that they do a 1 mile swim, a 3 mile swim, and increasingly a 5 mile swim. 5 mile swim is for kind of zany folks who really want to do that. The 3 mile swim has the people going fast in it. That's where the college kids from the swim teams, they race that one a little bit. But the mile swim, which I've done each one as well, the mile swim is it's more like a walk, if you will, the swimming equivalent of a walk. And you have all ages from 10 up to, I stood between the first one, between a girl who was 10 years old and the person on the other side of me was in his 70s. So all right. ages, and it's really quite a lovely event. So you can go register at the website, which is swimacrossamerica.org. Click down to the Baltimore Swim.
Right.
It'll take you right there, and you can get yourself going. Join a team or create a team.
Right. right. And you can, you know, Millie's Mermaids is still a team, but also there is a Kimmel team that you can join.
There is a Kimmel team. I have to be a free agent. I can't bias myself to any team. but it is totally a wonderful event. So you've described an incredible arc from a cancer diagnosis to survivorship, reengaging in work, and then turning your excess energy into now swimming and building the logistics behind Swim Across America event in Baltimore. It's really a remarkable set of achievements. What do you think about all this at this point?
You know, we teach now. I teach now the class. I coach now the class that was created for me and my team. And each year we get between 20 and 30 brand new
wow.
students. And they're coming because they want to do something for a family member, a friend, themselves. And this is a method that they can learn. They're taking on the same experience I did. They're learning to swim. They're learning to fundraise. And it's a remarkable achievement physically and emotionally when you get out of the water. And so for me, it's still those brand new swimmers that are coming in. And we have some of them that started in the class 3 years ago that are now can come back every year, and they've now raised $1,000, and their goal is to go to the 3 miles. And those swimmers, that still very basic, I can do this, I can thrive, I can help other people thrive, I can help them understand that they can do this. And if we get 100 people to raise $1,000,
we're off to the races, quite literally. We can race at that point.
We can race. So, you know, it's still, for me, it's just a very simple concept of this small act can prompt great research and great results.
So this is the way we're generating new funds for great new innovative research, Swim Across America with dedicated cancer survivors like Annie Applegarth. Great story. Listen to it. Come out to the swim, and believe me, you can't avoid meeting Annie and talking to her. And getting a hug from her. You'll have a great time in doing so. And please follow us at Hopkins Kimmel and check us out on iTunes. And thank you again for today.